hearing from you. For now, from me, Nikki Beatty, studio managers Bob Nettles and Duncan Hannant, and producers Lucy Collingwood and Kieran Birmingham, see you next week.
Next time you're browsing the web, click on over to KALW.org for the latest in local news and culture, updates from our music hosts, and unique features you can only hear from the talented crew at KALW Public Media. Visit KALW.org.
Where the time now is 6 o'clock. Your legal rights is next with host Jeff Hayden.
Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. We're happy to return to discuss landlord-tenant law, this being our spring installment for 2025. Last time we endeavored to discuss new landlord-tenant law changes went into effect since the start of the year. Has anything changed there? San Francisco's always a hotbed of activity. Are there any local changes afoot of which we should be aware? Or perhaps local changes that have been shut down? We'll talk about one or two of those as well. It appears there's quite a bit of construction around amidst a slowing economy. Has this eased the upward pressure on rental costs? Or just what did the imposition of a statewide rent control do to calm the market? As always, we want you, our most important guest, to call us and join in the conversation, so give us a call. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. But bear in mind that our attorney guests are here to educate and inform, perhaps even entertain. But they can't provide specific legal advice for ongoing cases they haven't seen. But they're here to help, can certainly give you guidance and help you sort out the legal principles and help you make some better decisions. And to give you that help tonight, returning, we have two of San Francisco's top landlord-tenant attorneys. For some 20 years, San Francisco landlord-tenant attorney Jessica Chalik represents clients in rent board actions, mediations, and in court for landlord-tenant issues. Jessica launched her practice to specialize in San Francisco residential evictions, vacancy agreements, and rent board petitions for tenants, landlords, master tenants, and subtenants. Also from San Francisco, attorney Salvatore Timpano is considered one of the top attorneys in the Bay Area to practice in the area of landlord-tenant law, representing both landlords and tenants in the area of eviction. And without further ado, Sal, Jessica, welcome back to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff. Glad to be here.
Hi, Jeff. Glad to be here. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Sal.
You know, one of the topics that keeps coming up that I keep hearing about, and of course I don't practice landlord-tenant law, but I keep getting asked about service animals. Can you deny renting to somebody because of a pet?
Well, so far in California, they haven't been able to pass anything that says that landlords cannot rent to people with pets, at least not to my knowledge. But service animals are not exactly pets. They are trained specifically to do a task, to assist the person. And it can be different. You know, they don't have to wear harnesses or anything that identifies them as a task-trained animal.
Okay, but doesn't everybody at some level think that their pets are service animals? I mean, I have pets at home and that calm me down. Doesn't that qualify?
That's more of a comfort animal, and don't rise to the level of service animals. Service animals are defined by the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they have to be animals, usually dogs, but exceptions are made for, sometimes monkeys and other things like that. But usually dogs that are task trained to assist their owner in some way. And that's the thing, is they have to be task trained. People who have emotional or mental health problems and need animals as a comfort animal, you know, to help them through, for example, depression or something like that. Generally not service animals unless they are task trained for things.
Which begs a couple questions. Are you even able to ask what if it's a service animal and what it's used for, he or she is used for?
Yes, you can. You can ask if it's a service animal, and you can ask what it's task trained to do, and that's about it.
So you can't deny somebody because they have a service animal.
But not on that basis alone, because it would be like denying them because they had a wheelchair or because they needed a cane or, you know, because they needed some other medical assistant device. They needed oxygen and have a little cart. You know, we've all seen people out and about that way. You know, a service animal is considered a medical aid.
What if you have two tenants or two tenant applicants, both wanting the same unit, both offering the same money? On paper, they're pretty similar. Can you use that as a factor in determining which one to rent to?
You used to be able to, but not now. Now you got to take the first application that you've received.
Jessica? They have to be taken in the order received, yes.
Yeah, so
That's one of the recent...
Do you know why that came about? Just like, what's the logic behind that?
Well, I think a lot of it is exactly what Jeff is asking. You have two applicants that look the same on paper, but one has a service animal, you know, and people were choosing against, you know, landlords or property managers were choosing against the service animals. And that could be, in effect, a medical discrimination, you know, based on a medical condition.
Yeah.
And obviously, if one of them's offering full rent and another one's offering $50 a month less, that in and of itself might be a factor you could decide by. But if they're both offering the same and they're both offering full rent, your hands are more tied.
Yeah. Correct.
Yeah.
Where it gets another interesting question I've been getting. What protections are available to tenants when another tenant's acts are unaddressed by the landlord, and that forces them to take action, whether it's to leave or to stay indoors and lock their doors because somebody else on the premises is not being a good neighbor?
Well, I mean, go ahead, Sal.
Yeah, I was going to say the victimized tenant would first start with the police if the activity of the offending tenant or occupant rises to that level. If not, then they report it to the landlord. And at that point, the landlord would have to take some action to allow the victimized tenant to have an apartment that they can live in peacefully and quietly. You know, assuming that it's all in the same building. Those are the ways that typically these things get handled.
Yeah, normally, once it gets to a landlord should write a letter to the offending tenant saying, you know, without divulging the victimized tenant, just say, we've had reports that whatever it is you're doing, you know, you're screaming and thumping on walls, or you're playing music too loud after 10 p.m. or whatever it is, you know, and this is not permitted and you need to stop. Start making your record. But if the landlord, as Jeff is asking, is not responding to that, or property management is not responding to that, then, in San Francisco, there is the Conflict Intervention Service. through the Bar Association of San Francisco. They provide, you know, I believe free or low cost, I believe free options to try to resolve those sorts of things, to try to get the landlord to respond, you know, to have an intermediary, somebody other than the tenant contacting them to say, you know, this is serious and you need to take it seriously. The landlord is responsible for what goes on in their building.
Yeah, it's part of the quiet enjoyment that the landlord-tenant contract requires. So the victimized tenant would turn to the landlord if nothing else under that provision. And that's mm-hmm. built into the lease, whether the agreement is written or oral. So
right, that through it, state law.
Right. And many times, if the activity would justify reporting to the police, then the landlord could tell the victimized tenant, you know, start there, because perhaps that will, you sure. know, if it's a criminal activity, then yes. that would be the proper place for it.
Sure, like a criminal activity, if they're, you know, selling drugs or if they're threatening people physically, you know, intimidating them or, you know, actually pulling weapons on them or something. Yeah, then that needs to go through the police. So there's a record that the landlord can get from the police in any kind of eviction action against the offending tenant.
Yeah, and I've also had occasion to be involved with requests for restraining orders. So it's not really a police matter, but it's kind of quasi, you know, not exactly civil either. So they'll go, the victimized tenant can request a temporary restraining order and then have a hearing and request to have it made permanent. And many times, you know, if that's granted, it might take care of the issue and then there's no reason for an eviction. Sometimes it's granted and that, you know, makes it even more of a reason for an eviction. So it depends, but that's another thing that a victimized tenant can do.
Let me turn it to our first caller, Judy in Berkeley. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Well, I'm really glad you guys are talking about this because I live in a subsidized housing building or whatever you call it. Anyway, about 28 units. And we have a woman here who's mentally ill, has something wrong with her personality and is an alcoholic who all of us are impacted by it. We can't even be moved anywhere because she goes down to the call box downstairs and calls all her phones. She pounds on her walls strategically to make as much noise as possible. I mean, she violates our plants. She throws our things away. And we supposedly they've been dealing with a lawyer, supposedly for a year, but they won't tell us what's going on. And they don't really help us. I mean, they're very hands-off, basically. They know what she's doing, and they say they're dealing with it. But not all we ever hear about is that she has rights because she's an older woman. She's an old woman. She's 80, and she's mentally ill and all this stuff. And nobody ever says that we have rights.
Well, one of the things that you can do is start keeping, you know, records of your own, you know, take photographs of if she's in the common areas of the building, then you can take photographs of her. So if she if you can take photographs of her pressing all the buttons on the call box or things like that, or, you know, keep a notebook or journal of, you know, it's 10 p.m. on Saturday and, you know, she's pounding on her walls or whatever it is, you know, and work to, those are sort of concurrent collection of evidence and that and landlords can use that. I mean, she does have rights, but you also have rights. It's a difficult situation for a landlord. And I know Berkeley has, you know, its own rent control system. So there may be limitations through there. I'm not as familiar with it as I am with San Francisco. South?
Well, actually, we have done a lot of documentation and the manager herself has documented stuff that's going on. And she's taken, you know, there's been videos of her. And they know what she's doing. It's not a question that they're ignorant of this. It's that we don't get the sense that they're doing everything they can to and that they actually they never affirm how onerous this situation is for us, you know, and it's just. And we can't get anybody to legally represent us, and we can't afford anything because we're all in subsidized housing.
Right, and so that's the other thing is with subsidized housing, there are other rights and that sort of thing that apply. You know, I'm sorry to hear that they're not keeping you up to date. I mean, obviously they have to be careful. There are certain privacy issues involved with, and so. You know, they can't tell you everything that's going on, but you should receive some sort of assurance that thing or update. So yeah. What do you think?
I think she should probably, if not already done, alert the housing authority that's providing the subsidy.
Because
they're paying the rent on your behalf.
You're supposed
to be able to live there in peace and quiet, literally in peace and quiet. So you would, as you know, you would probably just keep your correspondence to them, you know, keep your correspondence all in one place, and you can send the same letter to both your landlord and the housing authority, letting them know that the conditions are, you know, what they are: loud, noisy, threatening. You also can call the police. They would come to the property and, you know,
the police won't deal with it. They say it's a management issue. They won't deal with it. And HUD is not interested either because we tried to write to HUD.
Does Oakland still maintain a housing authority police agency that will perhaps be more interested than Oakland police?
It's Berkeley.
Under the housing authority, I mean, it's HUD who subsidizes us. Am I wrong?
Can you repeat that? I didn't hear it.
We're under Housing and Urban Development. That's our subsidizing agent, I believe. I don't think we're under the Housing Authority, from what I understand. I think I looked into that, and we're not. And HUD denied any interest in this issue. I wrote to them 2 years ago, and they don't care about it.
Did you contact the Berkeley rent board? There's a rent board in Berkeley.
Yeah, but I did try the rent board too, but it's kind of out of their hands because we're not under the auspices of the rent board in most respects. I mean, it's terrible. It's just like nobody really has anything to say about this.
Without telling us the parties' names, is your building or is it privately owned or is it owned by a public entity?
Resources for Community Development owns our building, and they also are not interested. It's managed by another company. They have an agreement with another company to manage us, and neither the management company nor Resources for Community Development is really addressing this in the way, in the most proactive way possible to get this woman out. You know, she's really horrible.
Wow. And you've called the police?
Have you or
anyone else has?
Yeah.
She said
they did, yeah.
Okay.
Many times. They will only arrest her if she's outside of the building, which they have done before. When she goes outside screaming and raving, they'll arrest her. But inside the building, they say it's not. We can't get involved with this. It has to be your manager.
Well, I think maybe it might be worth trying to talk to one of the East Bay nonprofits that help tenants, like Bay Area Legal Aid, that might be interested in a collective action on behalf of the tenants.
Yeah.
Or an injunctive action in behalf of the tenants, perhaps.
Okay.
The other place you might try is the Bar Association, Alameda County Bar Association.
Yeah, you know something, I have to tell you something, that I've never been able to get anybody through that. I think it's not working the same way in Alameda County as it does in maybe where you are. So that's something you might want to look into because nothing seems to be available.
I will follow up on that. I know that a lot of places, things got upset during the pandemic. It's harder to get referrals, but I know that I know of most most lawyer referral information services, whether it's San Francisco, San Mateo, Contra Costa, most of them are up and running full speed. I don't know the status of Alameda. I haven't talked to them of late.
Yeah. Anyway, that was my experience. But I appreciate talking to you guys. I will try one of the nonprofits that works with housing.
That would be what we all recommend. I think we're all on that same page.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for calling in. Thank you for joining us. And let me turn it to Mercedes in Oakland. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah. Hi. Good evening. I'm actually just calling with a comment for this program tonight, in the sense that it seems like a lot of, if I imagine a building owner who needs to try and solve a troubled tenant, someone who's causing other tenants problems, I can't even see that many actions they could actually take. I mean, you talked about writing a letter, somebody calling the police, okay, all of those things. But there are so many restrictions on what landlords can do and cannot do. And the burden is, a lot of burden is placed on landlords. I'm thinking, let's say, on small landlords that don't have, you know, a big, you know, corporate backing and a whole bunch of money to do all these things. And it's sort of that I find the tone of this program often, because I listen to it often, the approach of how landlords are often, in my opinion, treated as sort of the bad guy. And obviously this isn't always the case. This is a kind of broad brush statement. But I would encourage this program to really consider this as a kind of ecosystem. And, you know, just because the laws let people come after landlords for various things, and of course tonight you have a particular topic, doesn't mean that that's what's going to really solve the problem. And, you know, understand that there are exceptions to all of this, but it's disturbing to hear often the tone of how, you know, landlords seem to be expected to create miracles. You know, they're not people that have like a bunch of people that can go collect people with mental health issues. I agree that it needs to be addressed, but it just seems very imbalanced to me.
No, I understand your concern, and certainly callers calling in, honestly, the number of callers that call in this show, disproportionately tenants, oftentimes landlords have more resources, so they're less likely to call here. But it does seem that also the state of affairs are much more leaning in that direction right now. It's definitely the direction the pendulum is swinging. And we try to give people resources, but ultimately that same is true on the other hand. And there's nobody that's held captive a whole lot more than the small mom and pop landlords are. It's become a really unworkable position.
Oh, definitely.
Anyone who would go into that business almost volunteer, like, it scared a lot of people away.
Oh, sure. Some portion of my clients are mom and pop type landlords who most of them inherited property, you know, and they have their own where they live. So they think you're going to rent it out. And sometimes they do their research ahead of time and sometimes they don't, but they find themselves in some pickle or another, you know.
Right.
And if I own 200 units, I have a lot more options about what I do with people than if I own a duplex and I'm living in one and renting out the other.
That's right. And isn't it the case that the majority of housing in, I don't know if it's Alameda County or Oakland City, is 70% mom and pop, seeing that the way landlords are consistently portrayed is as the villain? It's very counterproductive.
It can be, especially when you're dealing with a mom and pop. They're not getting a lot of relief either. The corporations that own the big complexes, number one, they charge a lot more rent for what you're getting than mom and pops typically do. They also have a lot more control both over the tenants and over the market.
And they can afford the lawyers to do something about people.
Right.
So.
Well, thank you.
I mean, you know, and part of that, I mean, that's one reason why we refer people to the Bar Association referral services in the various counties, is because those programs have lower rate programs as well. You know, at least I know the Alameda County Bar Association used to, and I know the San Francisco one does. And, you know, if Yeah, it's you know, so sometimes
San Mateo
you can get
as well. They have either modest means or limited means panels for these same things.
Sure, you know, and I've got in historically when I was on the Bar Association of San Francisco's panel, I got some mom and pop type owners that way, you know, and some lawyers, when you go through the lower rate program, they have to provide a lower rate than their usual, whatever it is per hour.
Yeah, I think that lower rate applies to tenants and to landlords as well, because some landlords are close to upside down on their properties. It's pretty much an honor system, as far as I know, with whether or not they'll be referred to a lower rate. I do appreciate the comment about that. And I think as Jeff said, you know, if we get a question from a tenant about a bad landlord, then our responses are going to be geared towards taking those facts as true for purposes of responding. But we do get landlord calls. They're just not that many. And, you know, we're telling the landlord what our opinions are regarding their problem or their issue with their tenant. And, you know, those will seem more, you know, those responses are obviously going to be, you know, more in favor of the landlord, because that's who the caller is. But anyway, I do appreciate the comment, because that's, you know, that's some feedback that we can take into consideration, you know, here. Thank you for
that. Sure.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jessica.
I was going to say there are also some online available things that small landlords can look at. The California Department of Consumer Affairs has a landlord-tenant handbook online. And I know the California Apartment Association, while they generally represent, you know, the big owners and the big property managers and things like that, they do also work for smaller landlord holdings. And, you know, some of their information is free online. Some you have to be a member for, or like San Francisco has a local San Francisco Apartment Association that people can be a part of. So smaller landlords need to look around and see what resources are available in their county. San Francisco also has a Small Business Owners Association that has some landlords and some other folks in it. So, you know, you kind of have to look around. There might be things that you didn't think of.
And I'm very happy if I find a way to reach out to more landlords, because the service we're offering would reach them as well. Even in my own family, I've seen elderly folks that own a very small number of units and live on that income. And it's hard right now. It's a hard time for a small landlord.
It's scary for, you know, a small operator landlord, you know, to be in this business. It's scary. What happened in 2020, you know, wasn't even a thought that something like that could ever happen. And, you know,
you know, and the way that the insurance market is really running away from California.
Yeah, that's
people can't, you know, it's hard to get insurance. And if you're going to rent, you don't just get property insurance. You have to get a separate policy that deals with claims from renters. It's very difficult for mom and pops.
Yeah. Ultimately, at some point, I think, you know, all these problems will result in, you know, downward pressure on prices, because the investment value of these, you know, income properties isn't going to justify the expense of getting involved. So that, you know, I think it's just going to put downward pressure on the prices, which would also put then downward pressure on the rents. And there might, you know, we might get to a point where, you know, things start to make sense with lower rents, less competition, you know, and then the landlords can, you know, make a reasonable profit with, you know, charging lower rents, just because of the, you know, the prices of these properties might, you know.
You know, and there's a whole nother issue with, you know, single family homes not being available for people to purchase. because there's a lot of renters in single family homes that should actually be owners. You know what I'm saying? You know, historically, the process was, you know, you got your apartment, you got your starter home when you had a bigger family or you what retired, you swapped, whatever it was. There's not a lot of movement in the housing market because there's not a lot of housing to move in and out of.
Yeah, there are a lot of single family homes being rented out to tenants, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you're right, Jessica. That was probably the way it worked, you know, maybe, I don't know,
30, 40 years ago.
Yeah, it was probably that way. You got your apartment and then at some point you bought a small house and then, you know, bought a bigger house. I don't know if it's working out that way now.
No, there's too many people renting single family homes.
Yeah.
Mercedes, I want to thank you for joining us in Your Legal Rights, and we'll be back right after this.
One day my office phone rings, but the woman on the other end says, "My daughter's getting married in a few weeks, and you gotta save this wedding." And as she was hanging up the phone, she says, "By the way, I'm very, very rich." And she was.
Join us for stories of mama bears. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
The Moth Radio Hour this evening at 7 o'clock on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, and online at kalw.org. Where support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. What's the status of the landlord-tenant relationship? Are tenants still protected from eviction? What can landlords do? Do I have to pay my tenants to move? Are there now limits to a security deposit, and is it retroactive? Tonight's guests, Jessica Chalik and Sal Timpano, are among the best landlord-tenant attorneys in the city, if not the whole Bay Area. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Once again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. 8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. And Jessica, I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it.
Thank you, Jeff.
So, where did we leave off about a cleaning deposit or a cleaning fee? Can you charge those these days?
You mean like move-in? Jeff, like at the time of move-in?
I've seen that where a landlady charged that to move in. She wanted a cleaning deposit. It was considered part of the deposit. Had to be paid up front. Can you still do that?
I think the entire deposit, whatever it's called, is limited to 1 month's rent.
It is these days, yes, on a new tenancy.
So if there was a cleaning deposit, then it would just be part of that 1 month's rent.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Pet deposits, cleaning deposits, any first and last month's rent, which is not how things are done in California anymore, but people still do it. All of that is considered a security deposit, and under state law, it cannot exceed 1 month's rent on new contracts.
Yeah, I mean, that's really hard on the landlords, because you know they're just out there. Even if they're serving a 3-day notice, they're just going to be out there, or an eviction notice for non-payment of rent, for example. you know, typically they would be able to keep the security deposit and apply it to unpaid rent, you know, during the course of the litigation where rent's not even collected, or they could use it in some kind of bargaining to settle the case. But now that, you know, that it's cut in half, basically. So it might make it easier for the tenant to move in, because it takes less money to move in, but it's directly coming 100% at the expense of the landlord, who's right. less protected now. So, you know, it helps, you know, it helps the tenants, but it's coming directly. It's a help that's directly being funded by the other side of the person on the other side of the contract.
Worse so, yet, even when everybody does everything right, you have a tenant who paid on time every month, month after month. They took good care of the place. They decide to leave. They're moving away. They're going somewhere else, or they've got other plans. And you've got to cough up the deposit that they gave you however many years ago, 2 months, first and last, maybe a security deposit, and the person you're bringing in is paying a fraction of it. That's tough on the mom and pops. Let me turn it over to Eileen in Fairfax. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Hi there. I have somewhat of a two-part question, and I think I'm on the wrong side of this conversation. But my landlady comes on my property unannounced and, you know, it's when I'm not home on my property and has actually come into my house on several occasions without telling me. And the second part of it is, she's put up political signs in my yard that I don't particularly agree with, but because it's her property, I didn't know if I had any say that, you know, she can't put these political signs up in my yard that I personally don't agree with.
So is this a single family home or is it an apartment building?
It's a duplex.
Okay. Does she live in the other... Go ahead, Jeff.
I was just going to ask you, as was Jessica, the same question. Does she live in the other side of the duplex?
No, she lives in another town.
Then no, unless she's got... number one, she cannot come into your apartment, your unit, your part of the duplex without it being an emergency, or she has to give a 24-hour notice that she's going to enter for specific reasons.
Yeah, and, you know, notice would be good. You know, I mean, I just want to make sure everything looks nice, or, you know.
She's required by law. If she's going to. Yeah, well, if she's required by law. The landlords are required by law. If they're going to come in, number one, it has to be for a particular reason. To do repairs that were requested, to do repairs that, you know, come up annually, like changing smoke detector batteries and things, you know, those sorts of things. They can only come in for limited reasons. They have to give a 24-hour written notice who's going to be coming in, you know, what day, what time-ish. I mean, they can give a time frame, but, you know, and who's going to be coming in. Herself and whatever repair people or whatever. She can't come in just to snoop. She cannot come in to just, you know, look around and see what needs to be done or anything like that. That's no longer acceptable in California.
And she can't put signs in your backyard. If the backyard is part of your rental and part of the rental of the other unit, she has no right to enter the backyard. And the backyard is
not.
I'm assuming the backyard is not half yours and half the other duplex occupant, but just you have access to the whole backyard and so does the other.
I have half of, you know, like a nice patio area, and then the other tenant behind me does as well. That's the other thing. She's told me I can only have six plants on my property.
That's strange.
I mean, I guess it would depend if how big the plants were. I mean, if we're talking trees in pots, that can get heavy. But, you know, if it's just your normal pot of azaleas or whatever. You know, well, some sort
actually,
of
flower. You know, I'm sorry to circle back, but the signage was a real issue for me because I wasn't in agreement, and I just didn't feel like she should be able to put signs up when I'm renting that space, you know, especially promoting something that I don't believe in.
Where is the sign? Where is she putting the signs?
Right on the front gate, like right in next to the front gate door, like right when you walk into my property. You it's on the outside, but on the gate.
Oh, on the gate of the property.
Yeah, facing the sidewalk. So yeah, I can see where. I mean, since she does not live on the property, there's an argument to be made that she should not be posting, you know, anything even on the outside of the gates, other than maybe like a for rent or for sale sign. But but there's an argument to be made there.
I need 24-hour notice before you come, and you know you're not supposed to put signs up on while I'm renting here, or is that kind of a gray area?
Right. Are you internet capable? Yes. Well, the California Department of Consumer Affairs has a landlord-tenant handbook online, and it covers entry into the unit.
Okay. Great.
Is there any reason Eileen shouldn't throw up a couple of Ring cameras inside? Obviously, battery-operated, you know, ought to be running wires. But maybe tacking up a couple things to document it quietly?
Oh, I see. That's probably a good idea, you know? I mean, it's not that I mind. I just would like to know, you know? It just feels kind of like she came over the other day. My neighbor said she was in the yard cutting my flowers.
Well, no, she can't destroy your property.
My flowers on my rose bushes. So, you know, it's just a courtesy, I would think, to just let the
If she doesn't live on the property, she has to follow the rules of coming in. And if they're not her plants, she can't mess with them. I mean, you know, if you stick them in her ground that she owns, that might be a different thing. It then changes from being your property to potentially being a fixture. You know, if you make any permanent changes, that's why Jeff was saying, you know, the Ring cameras and things that are inexpensive and don't actually require wiring or drilling or anything, because you know that becomes a fixture that converts.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not interested in doing anything legally. I would like to be able to say you do need to give me 24-hour notice.
And the law that supports that is the number just went out of my head. Sal?
Is it 1954?
Yeah, it is 1954.
Yeah.
Civil Code Section 1954.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, best wishes with that.
And thank you for joining us. I would think, though, that Eileen would be well taken to approach it diplomatically. I don't know if I would lead with a really harsh approach.
I agree, Jeff. I think it can be. It sounds like the landlord means well and is just kind of misguided, you know, maybe doing things the way it was done, you know, many years ago.
Yeah.
And Eileen was describing somebody who seemed to be doting over the property in ways that might cross certain boundaries rather than somebody who's horrific. So
that's the impression I got as well. And it doesn't sound like she wants to draw a fight with the landlord anyway. So I do think that the softer approach is probably appropriate. And looking at the civil code, will just at least arm her with knowing what the landlord should be doing. If she's going to,
That'd be sending threatening letters, but to just know what your rights are and be able to talk about it is helpful. And I get the impression this is the kind of a landlady that Mercedes was talking about with the mom and pop, and this one may be a little misguided, but it doesn't sound like somebody who's trying to oppress or anything like that.
Yeah, I agree. That's the impression I got as well. Yeah. The gate, Jessica, putting something on that gate.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's an argument to be made that, I mean, depending on what the contract says, you know, everything depends on contracts, but there's an argument to be made that, you know, exclusive use of the property means all of it, including the fence, but.
Yeah, that gate would be, common to both units.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, so but then, the landlord doesn't live there.
Right, so it's not common to the land. It's not.
I mean, but the landlord owns the property, and that's an exterior. You know.
Yeah, it's kind of a gray area a little bit there.
Yeah, there's an argument to be made. Whether it's a winner, I can't promise.
Right.
And the other side of that is when you put it on the gate, it really infers an endorsement by the person on the other side of the gate.
Yeah, you mean there could be a safety issue?
No, I was thinking if she put it on the in front of the house facing the street and it wasn't right on the gate or right on the door, it doesn't necessarily infer that everyone who lives there is behind it.
Right.
When the gate you have to walk through to enter carries that, it tends to create an inference that that Eileen was supporting that cause, whatever it was.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And so on the gate is problematic. Next to the gate on the main part of the fence, I think there's an argument that could be made in Eileen's favor. But, you know, if there's like a sidewalk and then a strip of grass or whatever between the sidewalk and the street and the landlord wants to put stuff in that, no argument. She can do that.
Absolutely. That, in my mind, she's not saying Eileen's behind this too, the same way she is when it's at the entry to Eileen's house.
Right. Right. Ultimately, I think Eileen would prevail if it had to, you know, be decided, which I certainly hope, and I don't think that it'll go that far. I think they'll be able to work it out.
Right. And in many cities or communities, there are mediation services or community centers that will help people work out problems. Sometimes folks just need to have an opportunity to be heard or to have their point of view understood. And, you know, I've had good luck with places like community boards and, you know, conflict intervention services and places like that. So, you know, I mean, those, they're not as available as they used to be because a lot of funding is getting cut for nonprofits that help communities. But otherwise, I've had luck with them in the past.
So. One thing I did want to ask you about before we go. I'm aware of a law that changed. I think the state law may even be modeled after what San Francisco has been doing about making it a little harder to evict somebody because you want to use the property.
Right. Owner or relative move in under the Tenants Protection Act.
And
so, yeah.
I know there's a time period they have in order to move in. What happens if you need to do work on the property?
Well, you can see if there can be an extension because you can't move in within that time frame. In San Francisco, the owner move-in provision has just cause provision for eviction has almost always had a time frame to move in. It's been codified more recently, but you have to move in within 90 days and stay at least 36 consecutive months. And there's a lot of reporting that needs to be done for 5 years after the owner move in, just to make sure that people aren't taking advantage. And some of that is being extrapolated out and made part of state law.
And there's no, I see no provision in the rent ordinance for San Francisco landlords who move in, that really speaks to extending that 3 month or 90 day time period. From reading it, it looks like they've got to move in 90 days. Like they might have to do the work before the tenant is displaced if they think it's going to go over 90 days. And so much of that is out of the landlord's control because they have contractors to deal with, the city inspectors to deal with. And, you know, they don't necessarily move that fast. Weeks can go by and the landlord can find themselves, you know, in the middle of a project at the end of the 90 days and not be able to move in. I don't see anything in the rent board that allows the landlord a right to an extension. They can request it, and I've seen them denied in the past. It seemed very unfair, but I've seen those denied more than once in the past.
Does the beginning of the construction count as the beginning of your occupancy?
No. Unless you're living in it during construction. No.
So that would suggest that you probably have to pay the tenant off.
Right. It's kind of geared towards that. It's geared towards settling rather than having to go through that process. It doesn't say that anywhere, but that's exactly what it looks like to me, that it's geared towards the parties, you know, coming to some kind of settlement, and the rent board provides those move-out payments that I guess can be used as they're used as a basis for negotiations.
Right, if you're going to do a vacancy agreement instead of a owner move-in eviction to, you know, accommodate for the necessary repairs.
Yeah, a lot of times the repairs are so, you know, they require permits and inspections, so they might not, you know, I don't know about a lot of times, but there's jobs that just can't get done within the 3 months. And so the landlord would have to move in. What I don't know, Jessica, is what if they moved in and then left after a month to continue work? Would that still qualify as continuous occupancy? I haven't had that situation.
I think, you know, if they like moved in and their furniture and stuff was there and they were just, you know, they were just living in a hotel while work was being done that couldn't be done while they were in there, something that, you know, like lead removal or asbestos abatement or something like that. I think that counts in the residency time. Yeah.
I don't know. I don't read it, but I could see it going that way, but I don't read it in the, to me, the continuous occupancy would prevent them from doing that. Maybe they could argue that an emergency, like if the place became uninhabitable due to, I don't know, a fire,
mm-hmm.
I guess that then...
Some intervening thing, yeah.
Right.
A fire, you know, the plumbing breaks down or there's, you know, horrible rainstorms and, you know, the roof gets torn off.
Yeah, I guess there would be some kind of petition then, but from the reading of the relevant parts of the ordinance, I don't see anything that allows for them to be excused, the landlord to be excused from continuous occupancy. I don't see it. But, you know, there's probably some argument, you know, mm-hmm. with no guarantee that.
Yeah, arguments can be made, but I can't promise a win.
Yeah. You know, the rent board considers tenants occupants of a unit if they stay there, you know, more than 6 months a year, then that's their principal place of residence. I don't mm-hmm. know if that would apply to the landlord if they stayed there for 6 months and a day and then reapplied for a permit to do work that didn't get done because they had to move in within 3 months. You know, I mean, it seems like that argument should work for them. I don't know. I've never made the argument. This, you know, I've never had this particular situation.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, it's not perfect.
You know, one of the things that we spoke of before is having to give a tenant a bit more notice than before for an eviction. And as I understand it, San Francisco required a bit more than the state law did. And more recently, that's been litigated. How did that turn out?
So the 10-day warning letter it's been struck down by the appellate court, and it's no longer in the rent ordinance either. It's been removed because it added a procedural impediment to the time frame for an eviction, which time frames for eviction are governed by state law. So the local ordinance was found in violation of the state law's right to control procedural aspects of the eviction. You know, that 10-day warning letter, it's just my opinion. I mean, 10 days gets eaten up during the litigation very easily. So if the tenant's not going to pay, the tenant's not going to comply within the 3 days, or you give them an extra 13 days, if they're not going to comply, that's just 10 days thrown away. I don't know if that warning letter really did any good, because whatever they were being warned to stop doing, if they stopped doing it within 3 days, then the landlord would not be able to proceed with the eviction. You know, so why an extra 10 days? I mean, that's just my opinion on that. I mean, it struck down anyway for different reasons, but for my reasoning was, well, what is a 10 days going to do anyway? You know, it's going to give them 13 days to keep doing it, and they have to stop at the end of the 12th day. You know, and I don't know. It didn't make sense to me. It seemed like it was trying to help somewhere where it wasn't really helping anything. So I don't know. That's just my opinion. Did you have any opinion on that, Jessica, whether that 10 days was helping tenants?
It depends. I mean, you know, some landlords don't necessarily want to evict a tenant if they're paying regularly, but the 10-day warning letter helped with people who have stuff outside of their unit in the hallways and need to clean it up, you know, and they're not listening. You know, the 10-day warning letter with rent board on it kind of made them make attention. You know, I have a few landlords who don't necessarily want to evict their tenants, but, you know, need them to comply with things. And it was useful for that. Because it lent a bit of authority, because it had this rent board name on it.
Ah, yeah, I see what you're saying. You know, we have, you know, in lieu of doing eviction notices, we have sent, you know, I don't even call them warning letters, just notices that say, mm-hmm. you know, this issue's going on and we need you to address it. If, you know, we were trying to avoid sending an eviction notice, which is all we can do if this continues. So we would do those, and a lot of times those were effective. But to be forced to serve the 10-day notice, I mean, a lot of times those were for nuisances that were bothering other tenants in the building. Like, well, why should they endure an extra 10 days?
No, fair enough. But, you know, at the same time, I also understand that I always say, once lawyers get involved and lawyers' names are on letters or notices or things, it's just going to be a battle between lawyers. You know, the landlord and the tenant are both going to lose out. They're going to pay lawyers, and it's going to take too long and all of that.
Let me jump in with one last question. We're down to the last few seconds. And we've been talking a long time for the last few years, after with all the rent moratoriums that seem to have all finally run out, did that flood of evictions ever come? The one that everyone feared, did it ever come?
We didn't see it, Jeff. I didn't see it here.
I didn't see it in San Francisco either. I've heard tell that there was some in Alameda County or Oakland, but they've sort of worked that out a bit.
And that'll be the last word on the subject. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. where we focused on what's new in landlord-tenant law. Our guests tonight have been landlord-tenant attorneys extraordinaire Jessica Chalik and Sal Timpana, both of San Francisco. Our final guest tonight has been all of you. Our show's been produced by yours truly, and next week Your Legal Rights will take a look at your homeowners association. As always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. That's Your Legal Rights, Wednesday at 6 o'clock. A big thanks to tonight's guest and all of you for listening. And at the controls for Joanne Marr, Damian D. Minor, I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW comes from the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Law Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-161.